welcome to Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis. You can check out my books and social media at mindymcginnis.com and visit the Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire blog at writerwriterpantsonfire.blogspot.com. Today's guest is sci-fi author R.C. Lewis, a longtime friend and critique partner of mine. R.C.'s books include Stitching Snow and Spinning Starlight. We talked about how she got her agent and the writing forum that we both credit for helping us start our careers. One of the things that I always like to ask all of my guests about is the process through which they got their agent, because I feel like with a lot of aspiring writers, they want to find a route other than the querying process, because the querying process is so painful. Most of the writers that I know did, in fact, get their agents through the cold querying process. I think it is evidence that it works. And so I wanted to ask you about that. How did you get your agent?
My agent is Jennifer Loughran, who a lot of people know as Literati Cat on Twitter. And mine's kind of funny because I got her through regular querying and yet not. I was in one of those online pitch contests. It's called The Writer's Voice, modeled after The Voice, the singing competition on TV. The idea was we each had coaches that we got onto a team, and then they helped us refine things, and then we went live, and agents that were participating could make requests. Jen was not one of the participating agents, was kind of lurking on it, and she was tweeting one night, "Can I join in this? I'm a little late. I didn't know what was happening." And I saw that and I replied, you know, well, some of those might be in your query inbox right now, because I'd already sent off some queries just before the contest. So it might be in your inbox right now. And like, not really daring to hope that she even had seen mine, wanted mine, anything, because she was saying there's something I really want to go in and get. 5-10 minutes later, she emails me, "Please send me your full right now." Technically, like, I had queried her and there's no reason to believe that she wouldn't have eventually gotten to it. Yeah. But that got her attention a little faster than the week or two it might have taken her normally.
And your agent, she is a pretty big deal in the middle grade and YA arenas. I was aware of her when I started querying a long time ago, and she was always on my A-list. She probably has, I would guess, 200 to 300, maybe more, queries in her inbox per day. And so for her then to gain that interest in you through that contest to boost your query.
Definitely possible. I mean, that did have kind of that feeling of she's just kind of browsing the internet instead of going through the whole list of queries.
And did you ever find out, was your project one of the ones that she was actually inquiring about when she was tweeting? Or did she?
I tweeted at her that little hint, maybe some of the ones you're looking for in your inbox. And that's when she immediately responded to me. And I don't know if there were any others that she'd seen and wanted as well, but mine was definitely one that she was like, that's when I was gunning for.
That's so amazing. And so that was for your debut, Stitching Snow, correct?
It was. Yes, indeed.
What was your pitch that you were using?
Stitching Snow is a tale of Snow White in space if Snow were a cage-fighting tech head with daddy issues.
That's so beautiful. It's so perfect. I mean, immediately you have my attention.
The one and only time I think I'll ever come up with quite that style of a one-liner. And it's good because it's when I needed it and it worked.
R.C. and I met on a website called agentqueryconnect.com. It is a forum for aspiring writers. I had been wallowing in the query trenches for 10 years. And the reason why I was there for so long was because I didn't want to do the work of learning how to write a query properly. I wanted to be alone in the tower writing literature and dropping it to the masses and not doing the work and understanding the actual business. That's not how it works. So finally I said, okay, if I'm want to make this happen, I'm going to have to do it the right way. And one of the sites that I stumbled across and ended up making as a home for myself was agentqueryconnect.com. And it is a forum. And there I met RC. We met there and we became critique partners there. Why don't you talk a little bit about how AQC works, what kind of benefits it has to offer. Tell us about the community there and how it functioned and the benefits that it brought to you and me both, because I don't believe that I would have ever succeeded if it were not for AQC.
Oh, I absolutely agree. AQC, the focus more than anything was always on, you can post your query here and all kinds of people at different stages of experience and of the process and that write different genres and categories chime in and offer their advice and kind of help you shape that and see how effective it is. Some cold reader who knows nothing about your book, or you're so crammed for space there and trying to get as much important information to intrigue the reader as possible, that you sometimes don't realize how not obvious the connections are. So having all those different people there, young adult and middle grade, kid lit in general, but also there are some that are adult literature, you know, historical fiction. So a lot of things that we can still draw on their reactions. Is this clear and is this compelling to anyone who reads it?
I wanted to also touch upon another friend that we met there who has also gone on to be published by HarperCollins, who's Marcy Kate Connolly. She wrote Monstrous and Ravenous. Those are middle grade titles. These are people that I met online. That particular forum was really conducive to building real relationships outside of being an online friend. It's also important to point out, as you say, that it's not just a YA or a middle grade forum. There are definitely areas for that. There are the Verla K Blue Boards that are specifically for children's picture book, middle grade, and YA. Agent Corey Connect has forums and boards for every different genre and also different levels of experience. That's one of the things that I love so much about AQC is that when RC and I found it, there were authors there who were agented. There were some that maybe even were in the early stages of a book deal, but they were still there and they were helping others. They were giving feedback. They were giving advice. It was so helpful to have the input from someone that's just a few steps ahead of you. It's exactly what I needed.
I think it was R.S. Millett, when we started that group blog that we had for a while, how important it was to him and our mission statement that we were about, you know, as we are reaching ahead, it's important for us to also reach behind to help those along the way as others helped us as we were along our way.
R.C. is mentioning a blog called From the Right Angle. That is a blog that a group of us who met on AQC started in order to help other aspiring writers. It is no longer an active blog, but it is still up and running, and there's a lot of good information there.
I think we had some pretty good material there, especially for the aspiring and those who are in the early stages of the process, and even a little bit further along, like, what do I expect now?
Definitely. Up next, the emotional ups and downs of participating in pitch contests and the first four or five novels we wrote. Contests are a wonderful experience. You and I both have used them to our advantage. I think we've had mixed bag.
Ups and downs.
Yeah, exactly. Miss Snark's first victim is a blogger who goes by the name of Authoress. She is still running her blog. It is MissSnark'sFirstVictim.blogspot.com. She used to run a contest called The Baker's Dozen. It does not look like it is still active. However, RC and I both used the Baker's Dozen at one point in our
I think twice.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think you did too.
So yes, it's important to note that RC and I both, and Marcy Kate as well, when we met each other on AQC, the books that we were asking each other to read queries for are not published. They were not our first books, and in all three of our cases, are still unpublished. However, on this Miss Snark's First Victim, the Authoress blog, and the Baker's Dozen contest, those books in both RC and I's case continue to be unpublished. I think it's an interesting thing for aspiring authors to be aware of is that RC and I both, after doing the work, learning how to write a query properly and trying to understand both traditional and non-traditional methods to get an agent's attention, we still did not break through with that first attempt. So would you like to talk about the different books that you have queried before your debut got out there?
Really, when I joined AQC, you talked about how you'd been trying to be published for like 10 years and how you finally came to your senses and said, you know what, maybe I should actually learn to write a query. Well, I was kind of other end of the spectrum. I had just written my first novel the summer before, so summer of 2009, found my way to AQC, started querying in like January of 2010 with my very first novel. I mean, that thing, I must have racked up at least 100 queries over the course of quite a long time because I did query a whole bunch at first, wasn't getting any nibbles at all, so did some rewriting and revising. A brand new fresh query on that one where I'd done a lot of rewriting on the manuscript as well. I got a bunch of full requests. I want to say like 7 full requests out at one time. You know, you get your hopes up a lot because that's when some of our friends that were agented already, like, oh, that's totally critical mass. That's going to do it. And every single one of them just rejection. Did not go anywhere. And that's one of the ones that I know I did with Baker's Dozen the first time around was that manuscript. We got picked to make it onto the contest, so Authoress liked it enough, but didn't even get any nibbles from agents on that one first time around. I finally managed to make myself let that go, although it's you know, I haven't totally let it go. It's been completely rewritten since then, and we'll see if someday I get that out there.
You still mention that the Baker's Dozen contest occasionally. It comes up because...
Yeah, I mean, it was a little painful. It was like, oh, I think, okay, at least someone want to see, you know, a partial, not even a full, just want to see a few chapters, anything. And it was a little bit rough to see other people getting requests, and here I am just all alone at the dance, standing in the corner.
I don't believe I had any requests off that either. I was in that particular place where the query and the pitch and the hook had been polished to death, but the actual manuscript was not ready.
Yeah, my manuscript wasn't terrible, but the story structure and the arc of the whole thing, the conflict wasn't there. A lot of other things needed some help. Which
we were both still beginners at that point.
Oh, very much so, yes.
Yes, yes.
And that's okay, you live and you learn. Weren't you the one who, you did get a request on Baker's Dozen, but it was from someone who'd already rejected your query? And
yes, I did have someone request, and it was someone that had already rejected me. I contacted and they said, hey, would you like to see the pages? And they were like, yeah, sure, send them in. And then they were like, nope, yep, I remember why I rejected this. I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm glad I followed up. Up next, the constantly shifting world of publishing, where your editor might change overnight.
I think it was true for you as well. And I know it has been for some other people that my first manuscript, I would query anyone who said they represented YA, throw it at everybody. And every time as I went along, my list of people to query got shorter and shorter. And it wasn't necessarily that the people I wasn't including were bad agents. I think I was also getting better at researching and as well seeing their working style, seeing some of who they represent, hearing from other authors, especially once I joined Twitter and started networking a lot with other authors and hearing them talk about their agents.
I think early on in your querying journey and your publishing process, you don't necessarily ask those questions. You just say,
I want an agent.
And, you know, you learn that that's folly. Sometimes you learn it painfully. A lot of people go through 2 agents, 3 agents. I spoke with an author this morning who was on her 4th. That is by no means uncommon. And it also doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with the previous agents or with the author. It means that in some cases, people leave agenting, people leave the industry entirely. Sometimes their working styles don't mesh. And it doesn't mean that the relationship broke down in a fiery ball of hate.
I've even known some who the agent's still in the business, but shifts their focus to be nonfiction is where they're seeing the most success or where they need to focus their energy or something like that. There are so many reasons it can happen.
I think that sometimes can be another misconception for aspiring authors is that once you have an agent, that things are good. That's definitely not necessarily true. In talking with other authors, I think one of the reasons why that idea is so prevalent is because we use social media as a celebratory device. We use it to say, I have a book announcement. I got an agent. I have this new cover. We don't use it to say, hey, I broke up with my agent.
Not in the public arenas anyway. There's some closed groups. We usually seek out those closed groups for when we need to have that vent of, you know, I need to be with some people who are going to understand this. And I know it looks really ungrateful for those who are still trying so hard to get an agent, get those first steps. But there are those discouraging parts where you have to decide whether you're going to split up with your agent or when you lose an editor at your house and you know that.
Yes.
I know that one real well. And through no fault of anyone, it was for all good things. I had editors who, while in the midst of working with me, got basically promotions across to other publishing houses. So it was a step up for them. So it's a great and awesome thing. And I like to say that I'm really good luck for editors. So if you're trying to move up in your career, please, you want to work with me.
Next, agents, schmagents, and how to tell the difference.
And as my agent, Jennifer, would I'm sure say, you do also want to do your homework and be smart and be aware and watch out for, as she calls them, schmagents. She's actually expanded to schmublishers. In the internet age, anyone can put a thing out there and say, hey, I'm an agent now. Some are well-meaning, some are not. Some are people who truly want to do a good job and be agents, but maybe don't have the foundation that they need. So you do want to just be aware of their track record, their potential, kind of both ends of things.
Yes, and there are websites to help you learn how to separate the chaff from the wheat.
There is the Absolute Right forums, which are gigantic. There's often threads on different agents and people's experiences with them.
There's also Writer Beware, which is from the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America, the SFWA. And that you can access without being an SFWA member.
I remember seeing a lot more of just general practices type things. We're hearing rumors of certain publishers putting clauses like this into contract. Here are things to watch out for.
And that is definitely something for aspiring writers to be aware of, because you do not have to have any kind of qualifications to declare yourself an agent. You can simply say that you are, and you are. There are plenty of qualified people that aren't members of the AAR, the Association of Authors Representatives, and many legitimate agents are members of the AAR, and many aren't. That used to be a pretty good litmus test for the legitimacy of an agent. And I think that that is changing. I don't believe my own agent is a member of AAR.
What I remember looking for more often was a statement that they follow the AAR code of ethics. The thing is that I believe the membership requirements and the fees necessary to be a member were difficult, especially for newer agents. Agents often don't make money for the first bit when they become an agent, and often not enough to live on for several years. So to shell out big money for the association was sometimes a little bit difficult.
The most important thing to know is that an agent doesn't make money until you make money. They don't get paid until you get paid. They get a percentage of your advance or royalties, and that is it. Well, that is something that you can definitely use to identify a scam.
That's beyond a red flag.
There are lots of great sites that you can visit that have databases of legitimate agents. Yep. AgentQuery.com, QueryTracker.net, mm-hmm. which has both a paid and a free membership level. I highly recommend the paid. The free is awesome. You can get wonderful amounts of information out of it. Those are two. And as RC said, the absolute right water cooler is also a wonderful place.
And as far as training your own skills and honing yourself to spot things on your own, many agents mm-hmm. have Tumblrs and are open to ask agent type asks on there. I know my agent, Jennifer, does quite a lot of answering questions there. And that's where she posts a lot of her, here's what to watch out for in a schmagent. Some others have posted things similarly on their blogs or on Tumblrs and things like that. So when you find agents that are unquestionably legitimate, it's helpful to see if they have any resources like that where they've posted information on a blog or a Tumblr.
Next, RC and I talk about authors forums and the importance of a writing community, what you can get from one, what you should give, and where you can find them, as well as the more personal relationship of a critique partner, how to get one, how to be one, and how to process their criticism. One of the non-traditional routes that you went with early on was a site that is no longer functioning, but I think it's worth talking about just as an example of a method that you use to hone your craft prior to being agented and published, and that was a site called Authonomy. What was Authonomy about?
Authonomy was kind of an interesting little place. I see it as odd little precursor to some other things we've seen since, like Wattpad, for instance. People could post either just chapters or their entire novel onto the site, and they could give it a genre. And then there was a ranking system where people would go through and read and review and give votes. You could pick 5 books to put on your shelf, and that counted as a vote for that. And every month, in the top 5 or so for the entire site would get a critique from a HarperCollins editor. It kind of had a little bit of a competition gamesmanship thing going on a lot of times. There were people who were kind of working the system a lot, but it also had an attached message board. People could leave reviews on your work as well. So before I had actual critique partners, that's where I got my first doses of feedback and learning how to give feedback to others. And then the mm-hmm. message boards, they were my first writer's community before I went over to AQC and met you and all those other wonderful people. But there mm-hmm. were some great people there at Authonomy too that I stayed in touch with and see around, and several have been published. I did get to the top of the shelf with that first manuscript once. And so I got a critique from some anonymous HarperCollins editor that probably made some pretty fair points about the things that were strong and the things that really did need some work, because I just wasn't quite there yet.
That particular manuscript is unpublished.
That's just the living and learning and growing as a writer. And sometimes you put things right in a trunk forever, and sometimes you bring them back out.
I want to talk quite a bit about finding critique partners, how to find them, how to use them, and how to be one. We met on AQC, and I can't hit enough how important that forum has been to me and people that we have met there, all of them phenomenal in their own ways. I'm going to name a few people that we met there.
Let's name drop. Let's totally name drop right now.
Marcy K. Connolly, of course. Riley Redgate. Riley, I love Riley. She has a new book coming out, and she wrote 7 Ways We Lie.
And then Noteworthy is her new one coming out this year.
The historical author who writes under the name Sophie Parenow, was a major player on the AQC boards and one of the first people to give me feedback.
I always kind of viewed her as like the mama bear around there.
Oh, she's the matriarch.
She's totally the matriarch. No nonsense, but she would make sure you didn't fall off the deep end without knowing what was going on. But she also wouldn't put up with malarkey of any kind.
She's going to take care of you. She's going to make sure that you don't get hurt, but she's also going to call you out on your shit. So
that definitely, yes.
She's fantastic and an excellent writer. So we met her there, and as well as Stephanie Diaz, who wrote
the Extraction trilogy.
That's right. We met Steph there, as well as Matt Sinclair, who runs Elephant Bookshelf Press out of New Jersey, which is an indie publisher that he started up. So we've both worked with him on anthologies there. I have short stories published in 5 anthologies from Elephant Bookshelf Press. Yeah. But you also did a lot of editing work and also digital design work.
Yeah.
It just grew out of our community there that we were able to learn some new skills and branch out and dip our toes into different arenas along with Matt as we learned these things. And then, of course, Stephen Duncan. I need to mention Stephen, who wrote The Revelation of Gabriel Adam. He is also an old guard from AQC. Am I forgetting anyone?
Robert Lewis is a adult thriller writer, crime.
That's correct. Along with Pete Warren.
Yes, Pete Moore is actually the reason that I found AQC, because he was over on Autonomy, and I was starting to think about querying, and I was kind of looking on the message boards there to see if anyone could help me with the query, and he pulled me aside and was like, I have a site over here where people are totally into that and critiquing queries, so come on over.
And then there was also R.S. Millett, who you mentioned before. He had written for Xena, Warrior Princess, and he was an extra on Deadwood, which I picked his brain about for a long time, the poor man. Yeah, I mean, there's all different kinds of people.
R.S. has the best stories.
Oh, God, he certainly does.
His writing is fun, but just his stories just of life in Hollywood and all kinds of things.
Oh, yes. We all met there and all have gone on to have experiences in other arenas. And one of the things I enjoyed so much about the group that we had there is that there were so many different backgrounds in film, in historical, and
in law.
Pete actually looked at my contract for me.
When I said that I got an offer of representation, he's like, do you want me to take a glance at your agency agreement just to make sure it looks okay?
Yes, and those are the kind of connections that are just invaluable and you don't necessarily expect to walk into. It's a wonderful added benefit. So these are all people that we met on AQC. The closest knit group as far as becoming critique partners would be RC, Marcy K, and myself. I think it's really important to talk about being a critique partner and the importance of them, why you need one, how to be a good one, and how to take criticism, because it is criticism. We do not exchange manuscripts with each other and then give each other compliments.
I don't know if I said a single good thing about that short story you just sent me.
No, I don't think you did.
The good stuff will come, but you know that I'm there to just tear you down and build you back up again. That's my purpose
exactly.
in life.
That's exactly. Your purpose. I don't send it to you for compliments. I send it to you so you can tell me what's wrong. Getting a compliment is not going to make me improve.
You've got your mother. You can ask for compliments if you need them, right?
No, my mom hates my stuff. You know that.
I was going to say, we got something else. Does your sister say nice things? I don't know.
No, not really. There's plenty of people that like me. No one I'm related to. It's a great point, though, because as a critique partner, I think it's very important to have that relationship. We didn't start that way. When we first were exchanging critiques, we were a little more careful with each other. We know
sure
each other well enough now that we can do that.
I'm sure we were much gentler back then. Yeah, and that's part of the thing. You kind of need to start feeling each other out when you're in the early days of a critique partner. A lot of people will recommend this, that, you know, when you're starting out, just start with exchanging a couple chapters. Just kind of see, you know, if you can kind of work with each other's style, if the stuff that they write is something you can stand to read in a non-finished form, something you want to believe in and want to help build up. Because I don't want to sit through 70,000 plus words of a story that I have zero interest in. You can't be suffering the whole time, or it's not going to be a very good relationship.
No, you can't. Yes, you need to believe in it. And you're also, you are not going to give them good feedback if you are that unhappy mm-hmm. with it. Like, if you don't see a glimmer of hope or a kernel of truth,
potential of some kind,
even an untapped potential, yeah, you're not going to be able to give them what they need. And it could very well be a subjective thing. For example, you're aware, I am not a huge sci-fi fan. I like it. I enjoy it. But it's not something I'm going to pick up normally. And you and I came to critique for each other simply because I believe Marcy Kate pointed us to each other.
It was that, and there was another writer, screen name Sky Val. Actually, you know, I think it was her and not Marcy Kate. And so she was reading mine and I was reading hers, and she was like, hey, you know what? Big Black Cat BBC over on AQC, because that's all any of us knew you as at that point, I'm pretty sure. Does really awesome wine, is a really great reader, and I bet she'd read for you. And she just kind of, I think, saw that we had similar but different enough styles that we could work well together, but also help each other in areas that each other was weak.
That's a really key point to a relationship, a critique partnership that works, is that we complement each other's weak spots. So, for example, I mean, you're well aware that I don't know how to use a comma.
I was going to say, if you didn't have me, you'd still be having comma splices throughout everything, and you've gotten so much
everywhere.
Better.
I love them. I love commas. Every manuscript I get back from you, at least 15 to 20 little smiley faces in the margin where it says, oh, comma splice.
Take that. There's another one. You got me on my first manuscript, and the eyebrow movement of my characters was like out of control.
That was your crutch. Everyone was always raising an eyebrow. If they were even slightly inquisitive, they would raise an eyebrow.
I had an excuse. I was still teaching at a school for the deaf at the time. I was operating in American Sign Language all day long. And
that's correct.
Eyebrow movement is part of the grammar. Okay, so it was coming out.
Yeah, you know very well that I dislike character movement. It's a huge thing for me. I don't care if she's scratching her head while she talks. It doesn't matter. And so I would cut that from your stuff and say, this doesn't matter. But then, of course, you have the freedom to say, it does to me. That's a really bad example because that doesn't matter.
Turnabout, fair play, that I have also found times in yours where it was like, okay, the last we knew, they were sitting in the living room and suddenly they're in a car. You need to actually get them from A to B a little better.
That's absolutely true, because I'm just like, I'm not moving them. They don't have to move. And you're like, yeah, but you see, Mindy, it actually doesn't make sense.
You need to give a little hint so that our mental movie is actually changing the scene like it's supposed to.
Right. And that's a great example of you might overwrite character movement a little and I might underwrite it a little. And so we balance each other out. And that's the kind of thing that you... If you're lucky, you can find a critique partner that balances you in that way. And then I want to add that you bring Marcy Kate into the mix.
Yeah.
And Marcy has a wonderful ability to look at something and say, okay, but what is she thinking right now? How did that just affect her emotionally?
Oh, yeah. And she's definitely there for the emotional context, which I'm so weak on in my first drafts. They don't exist in first drafts. No one has feelings in my first drafts. Hardly. But I know it. And yes. I try to put some in before I send it in to you guys. But you should see, like, before I even send it to you, like, I'm writing about robots all the time. But, yeah, I rely definitely on Marcy to let me know when even the parts I put in is still not enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that she has a keen eye for. And that harks back to what you were mentioning before. As a writer, when you are putting together a query, you are filling in the blanks on your own because you know that the bad guy is the bad guy, but it's not actually in the query. And you know how the character feels in this situation, but you didn't write it in there. The reader doesn't know. You didn't inform them. You as the author were already aware because you are the omnipotent force. So you know how they feel.
Yeah. And I think
you may not have put it on the page.
And that's a craft area that I think takes just endless amounts of practice that we all can keep growing in, because you don't want to have everything on the page. You want to leave some things to subtext and infer different things and leave it to the reader to get between the lines on some things. But you also can't just leave them flailing where in these leaps that they cannot follow you through. And that balancing point is, it changes from story to story and depending on your audience and your goals and intentions. So again, having other eyes on it, you all have three of you read my manuscript and one of you says this and two of you say that. And I'm like, okay, you can all be right, but which one do I need to listen to more given the audience I'm going for? Or which one, you know, how can I maybe marry all three opinions together to achieve this goal? Or do I throw it all out and try something totally different, which I think I called finding option Q or something. It's like, try A, B, C, finding your Q, yes. Because A, B, and C, I don't like any of those options. So I need to find a Q that addresses all of them.
Your critique partners are just human beings and everything is still subjective. So your critique partner might give you feedback that you disagree with, and that is perfectly fine. It is your novel in the end. My rule of thumb is that if one person points it out to me, it's an opinion. If two people say it, then it is probably true. And if three say, then it is a fact. So yeah. If I have one person say, you know, I'm not relating to your main character, then it could be subjective. They could just not be connecting with them as a human being because they are so divergently different people. But then if there are two people that are struggling, how does this percentage play out? What is this ratio that two people aren't connecting of the three that I've shared with? And then if three people aren't connecting, you have a problem. You didn't execute a human being on the page. You have to always weigh everything that your critique partner says and take it seriously. But your critique partner isn't making the decisions for you. That's a really important line to walk.
Yeah. You mentioned how, like, for instance, you are not the biggest sci-fi consumer mm-hmm. in the universe. Mm-hmm. And I am likewise. I still am not super into the contemporary fiction scene. For instance, I'm a lot more at home when I'm critiquing your fantasy, for example, than when I'm critiquing sure. your contemporaries. If someone's going to read your book that isn't necessarily a fan of that genre, how are they going to see it? I'm not so familiar with all the tropes and things that go along with it. Same thing with sci-fi, that you don't necessarily have all the same background, but I need to know that someone who's just a casual reader that wants to enjoy my book, can they follow my story still without all mm-hmm. that background information?
I was reading for someone that wrote magical fantasy. She had a character that needed to go out on the street, and so she threw a glamour up so that she wasn't recognizable. Yeah. And I had no idea what that meant. Like, this was outside of my realm. I didn't know what a glamour was. I was like,
what? You didn't watch The Craft when you were young like I did.
I didn't watch The Craft. I didn't know what a glamour was. So I asked her, and she was like, well, fantasy readers will know. What about the 200-300 that pick it up and are like, I don't understand why the person that she knows that she just walked past has no idea that it's her. You have critique partners outside of your genre. It's very useful because for her, there was no question in her mind. Glamour is a glamour. I know what that is. Period. I didn't know. I didn't need it spoon-fed, but no, I needed those context clues.
And that is where you get to show your deftness as a writer, where you can make it accessible to everyone. Context, a little nod, a little aside. That's how I learned half the words I know, is from reading books and figuring it out from context, right? Like, I've always tried to make my sci-fi as accessible as I can because I am a huge mm-hmm. science nerd. I'm a math teacher. I am a geek. I know more than I need to know about a lot of things. And I need to remember that not everyone knows all the things I know, nor should they, nor need they to. So finding that balance of how to get enough of it in there that they can figure it out without being like, here is a science lesson in the middle of chapter 5.
Finishing up with RC's day job, her books, and the marriage of logic and imagination.
So I would love to talk about your day job because you are a full-time math teacher. And I'd like to actually backtrack a little bit to when I met you and you were teaching advanced calculus to deaf students. So you were teaching complicated subjects in a foreign language because you were teaching them in ASL.
In my second language, yes. I taught calculus and I also taught classes of very basic math. I covered pretty much the whole high school math curriculum spectrum, which was mm-hmm. really fun and challenging. And I always say, now that I'm back in regular ed where I have close to 200 students, but I teach pretty much the same thing to all of them. School for the Deaf, it was a ton on the preparation end, but like my biggest classes mm-hmm. were like usually 4 or 5. I once had a class of 8 a couple times. That's mm-hmm. it. So not much on the grading end, but tons of prep. And now I'm the other way around. I'm a math teacher, which my students more than once have said to me, then why don't you teach English? And my first answer is because I was already a math teacher when I started writing novels. But also I think it's really fun for me to see their brains twist around it and realize, oh, you can be a math person and like stories and writing and English side of stuff. This idea of that you can only be one thing is a little bit locked in their heads still. My deaf students really enjoyed it too, that just seeing different avenues of possibility. You don't have to pick just one thing. I'd print out copies of the stuff I was working on. This was when I was very first starting to write, and they would read it during free reading time and give me advice and feedback. And their favorite was always Fire Weaver too. So why I get it's the not quite Harry Potter thing. I'm like, of course you like that one, but no.
The novel of the people.
I've always enjoyed math and just science in general. I almost became a physics teacher instead, but decided it was the math part of it that I liked the best. So that's when I got into math education. And I really enjoy, my students maybe don't enjoy it as much, but I enjoy pushing them to utilize their communication skills. I think has kind of bridged over from my writing abilities to create lessons that force them to do that a little more. Because just memorizing a math procedure and churning it out and not knowing how to ever actually use it or reason or think critically is not going to do them much good. You need to communicate why this is true, not just memorize some fact and trust it because I told you so.
I think that's a lovely point, that you have a good marriage of logic and reason with creativity, and they're not mutually exclusive.
I bring that logic and reasoning to their critiquing even, because I will totally get after you if you have a logic gap of some kind. Yeah.
Let's talk real briefly about the books that you have out there right now. You have Stitching Snow and Spinning Starlight. But why don't you tell us a little bit about Stitching Snow, which has a glorious cover.
I do love that cover. Stitching Snow, I was kind of intending it more to be just inspired by Snow White, and it turned into a little bit more of a actual retelling as it went along, picking up quite a ways through. The evil queen has made the attempt on her life, and she's run away, and she's living in hiding on this desolate, cold mining planet, scraping out a living, trying to make sure no one finds out who she really is. Mysterious stranger crash lands his shuttle just outside the mining settlement and throws everything into chaos. We have our seven quote-unquote dwarves, which is our little drones or robots that she's designed that originally worked in the mine, and she upgraded them to have some degree of some artificial intelligence. They have all their personalities.
I like Cusser. Cusser's my favorite.
I know Cusser's your favorite, and actually Cusser's role got a little bit magnified and elevated after you decided you loved him so much. So that's all thanks to you. She goes through all that and deciding if she's going to do what needs doing and save everyone in her own way.
Because you are the person that you are, you developed a solar system and actually, I believe, had distances spaced in between the planets so that they would function properly in their universe. Well, is that correct?
I'm cheating a bit on like livable planets and how many there could be in a single solar system and how far they would be from each other, but I made it.
This is where the marriage of logic and creativity gets into a little spat. Your second novel, Spinning Starlight, is also based on a fairy tale retelling, but it's one that is slightly less recognizable. So why don't you tell us about that one?
Well, I should mention a couple of other people we knew sort of originally through AQC, and Charlie Vale and Tess Sharp. I was chatting with both of them and some other people on AQC one day. I knew my publisher wanted to have my second book in my deal be another fairy tale retelling, sci-fi style. The Snow White one just came to me because I was listening to a Florence and the Machine song in the car on the way home from work one day. So that was just like cosmic happiness. And I just wasn't looking for it. It just happened. Now I had to go looking for one. So I kind of was asking them, what are some favorite fairy tales that aren't totally overdone? Both Charlie and Tess talked about how much they love Hans Christian Andersen's The Wild Swans. Sometimes it's called The Seven Swans, Seven Brothers. Sometimes the number changes to 11 swans. It's got a few different versions out there, like most fairy tales do. If you don't know the fairy tale, it's the one where there's a princess. She's often like the youngest of several children, all these older brothers. Evil stepmother queen comes into the picture, doesn't like any of them, curses the boys to all turn into swans at night. And sometimes specified in the moonlight, they become their human form again. And eventually the brothers form a net and carry her across the sea to another land where she can be safe. And she has this dream one night as they first arrive there that if she knits shirts out of nettles, crushes nettles from her graveyard to make flax, and then knits shirts for each of her brothers out of those, then that will turn them back into themselves, break the curse. But she cannot speak until the task is done. And right after that, the king of the land comes by and sees this unspeaking but really pretty woman and says, okay, I'm going to marry you, which, you know, sometimes fairy tales have these things going on that you're like, really, what? But she sneaks out at night to go to church graveyards. People see her sneaking out, accused of witchcraft. She's still in prison trying to finish these shirts, is taken to be burned at the stake. And just before that, the last shirt's almost done, just missing a sleeve. She throws it onto the one brother slash swan. All the brothers turn back into themselves. She can speak again. The one brother who didn't have the sleeve, though, is stuck with a wing instead of an arm. Sorry.
I guess
that's the price that must be paid. And somehow it all works out. So that's my too long version of the fairy tale for those who don't know it. Somehow I took that and turned it into a sci-fi version that doesn't have a single swan anywhere in it. Yeah, I mentioned a constellation that's the swan. And so my main character can't speak for like 80% of the book because I did keep that part. So that was a fun challenge. Since it's sci-fi and futuristic, I had to deal with, well, if she can't talk, she's just going to write. Like, you know, we're going to pull out our smartphones and just type at each other. What's the big deal? So I had to decide that she's from such an advanced society that they've got like voice and icon activated everything and have decided they don't really even need writing systems as much anymore.
You were writing a book with a main character that could not speak at the same time that I was writing A Madness So Discreet, in which yes. my character is suffering from trauma and is a selective mute for a good amount of time. And so we were both faced with main characters that don't speak. In your case, which was a unique challenge. And in your case, she cannot speak because the evil stepmother has implanted an explosive device in her trachea. Is that correct?
The evil stepmother stand-in, no actual relation to the character, but yeah, has
yes.
implanted a device in her throat that's going to, if she speaks, will cause her brothers to be killed.
So that one is called Spinning Starlight. Why don't you, to finish off here, let us know some of your social media follows so that people can find you on the internet.
The main place I'm at is on Twitter, and I am at @RC_Lewis. I'm a little bit on Facebook. I need to do more on Facebook. If you look up R.C. Lewis there, or author R.C. Lewis, I believe I am. And my Tumblr, rclewis411.tumblr.com.
And do you have an Instagram?
Yes, that is R.C. Lewis Books is my Instagram.
Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire is produced by Mindy McGinnis. Music by Jack Corbel. A special thank you to fellow author Alyssa Palumbo and patron Stephen Avery for helping to make this episode possible.
If you find the blog or podcast helpful, please consider showing your support by visiting patron.podbean.com/writer-writer-pants-on-fire and making a donation. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist.